Is the mic, there it is. Working now?
Yeah.
If I could have your attention, thank you. Welcome back to the Faith Angle Forum. This is our 29th Faith Angle Forum. We've been doing this now for 17 years. We started in 1999. Grant Wacker was one of our speakers. Ken Woodward was there. Some of you are vet. Yes. For those of you who are new, let me just tell you quickly some of our ground rules, which are very simple. After our speakers speak, give their presentations, I will keep a running list of who wants to get in. Just signal me with your hand and make sure that I see it, and then you can take it down. that way we can move along with civility and with order. I would ask now that you mute your cell phones, please. And also that you would mute them again. please, if you would, try to limit your side conversations with people next to you. They can be distracting to others. But I would want you to know that you're free to tweet away about what you're hearing and what we're doing. The hashtag is hashtag FaithAngle16. It's in your program. And now, please feel free in the back of the room. If you've been here before, you probably already have one of these. But if you don't, we have this mug is in the corner room there, and it's for you for free. So help yourself. There's a limited edition. The mugs are on the house. Every 4 years, we take up this topic after a national election. For obvious reasons, we want to know how religious voters voted in the election, and it seems like every 4 years, we have two of the best people in the country, and those are our guests today. I think it's the third time for Carlin and Bill Galston, and they are always a hit, and we always get rave reviews, and so we like to have them back. I am not one to read back to you what's in your program of their biographies. When I go to conferences, people stand up and they just read to me what I'm reading in front of me. Please read their bios. But I would simply say that in Washington, Carlin and Bill are highly respected by people on all sides of the spectrum for their balance, their even-handedness, their objectivity, and that's why it's such a delight to have them here today. So we're going to hear from each of them, and then we're going to get our Q&A going. So first up is we welcome Carlin Bowman from the American Enterprise Institute in Washington, D.C. Carlin, thanks for coming.
Mike, thank you very much.
Push the button.
Oops, sorry.
By the way, let me just say that when you do intervene, pull these microphones over. That's for the purpose of the transcript. We transcribe everything that you say, and we put up the audio, the transcript, and now, and we are even videoing our Faith Angle Forum. So when I call on you, try to get this microphone over in front of you and just push the button when the green light comes on. Okay, Carlin, thank you. What's that? I hope you brought your makeup with you.
It's a great pleasure to be back at the Faith Angle Forum. I haven't been back for a decade, and it's really a pleasure. In both of their post-election analyses, the Pew Research Center and the Public Religion Research Institute described the election in very similar terms. Pew's preliminary report on how the faithful voted began this way. The 2016 presidential exit polling reveals little change in the political alignments of U.S. religious groups. Dan Cox, writing for PRRI, said this: in an election that provided a slew of unpredictable turns, the religious vote broke along strikingly familiar lines. While the alignments were familiar, there were many interesting stories in the data in 2016, and I'm going to go back and talk about a few of them. I'm a public opinion generalist and not a specialist on public opinion on religion, but a few things caught my eye this year in the pre- and the post-election commentary about it. In an article written shortly after the election, the Democratic pollster Stan Greenberg discussed yet again the rising American electorate, the collection of millennials, minorities, and single women that were thought to be the key to the Democratic victory in 2016 and forever after. But in Stan's post-election summing up for the Democratic strategist, he added another group, secular people. Those who check the box none on the exit poll when asked about their religion voted solidly for Hillary Clinton by 68% to 26%. They were more supportive of Clinton than were millennials or single women, two key parts of the rising American electorate. In 2016, the nuns were 15% of all voters, up from 12% in 2012. Among voters, Protestants at 27%, Catholics at 23%, and white evangelicals or born again at 26% were all larger shares than were the nuns at 15%. But among all Americans in PRI's compilation, the religiously unaffiliated are now a larger share than any other denomination. In Pew's 2014 data looking at the religious landscape, again looking at all Americans, the unaffiliated are a larger share than Catholics or mainline Protestant. In Pew's data, 3.1% of the religiously unaffiliated call themselves atheists, 4% agnostic, and 16% nothing in particular. In every presidential election since 2000, more than 6 in 10 of the nuns have voted for the Democratic candidate. They gave the highest share of their votes, 75%, to Obama in 2008. In electoral terms, the nuns are growing and will be more significant politically in future elections. Around 35% of millennials in Pew's data are religiously unaffiliated, compared to 17% of baby boomers. This reminds me of two surveys that were done in 1988. The first was done by Peter Hart for Rolling Stone, and the second was done for Time magazine when they were polling with Yankelovich. That year in 1988, they surveyed baby boomers and asked them to think back to their views in the 1960s. They asked questions about whether they were active in the Vietnam War, active in the protests, what they thought about a lot of different issues overall. And one of the things I think that was interesting about that those particular polls that came to remarkably similar conclusions were that people in baby boomers in 1988 all agreed that they'd become, by very substantial numbers, agreed that they'd become more conservative since the late 1960s. They hadn't become more Republican, but they said they'd become more conservative. They were asked about things such as more children in daycare, less religious observance for young people, and all of those said that they thought, all of the baby boomers said that they thought those were changes for the worse. And so one of the questions, obviously, about the nuns is whether these attitudes will change over time. I think clearly the jury is still out. The nuns are one of the big religion stories of recent years, but in thinking about them, I'm reminded of a question that Gallup asked many years ago about whether gambling and separately drinking had ever been a cause of problems in your family. Over time, more people told Gallup that these were problems in their families. Did the levels of drinking or gambling really change, or did more people just feel comfortable talking about it? Are the nuns growing, or are more people simply willing to say they have no religious affiliation than gave that response in the past? Were the nuns hidden in the past because it was socially unacceptable in our more judgmental country to give that response? And are they out in the open today because it is socially acceptable? We know that 9 in 10 Americans, including a majority of millennials, still say that they believe in God, and nearly half nationally, 49%, pray daily in a new UVA poll, and an additional 15% pray several times a week. A quarter in the UVA poll said that their religious beliefs are the most important thing in their life, and an additional 55% say that they are very or fairly important. There is more agreement, I think, on what the rise of the nuns might mean for politics than what it means for religion, though the phenomenon is obviously important for both. But the religious landscape, as all of you know, is clearly changing, and trust in organized religion continues to decline. In Gallup's 2016 confidence battery, trust in two institutions, newspapers and the church and organized religions, dropped to record lows. 30% had high confidence in newspapers, 41% in the church. PRRI pointed out that Trump performed very well in states with large Christian populations, such as those in the industrial Midwest, and less well in states such as California, where there are fewer white Christians and fewer believers. Trump won nearly every state with a majority of a white Christian population. According to PRRI, the proportion of white Christians in a state was more strongly correlated with Trump support than the proportion of white working class voters. These Midwestern states are older and whiter, and one of the big themes in this election was the cultural nostalgia and alienation these voters supposedly felt. Some in those states clearly did feel left behind by a changing economy and a changing demographic mix. A question that PRRI has asked several times finds that Americans are divided about whether American culture has mostly changed for the better or changed for the worse. There are deep divisions on the question. Republicans and Democrats are mirror images of one another when they answer it, with Democrats believing the culture has changed for the better. 2/3 of the unaffiliated say it's changed for the better. Just 25% of white evangelical Protestants give that response. Nostalgia has long been a powerful current in our society and in our politics. Bob Dole remembered a time when things were better, building and wanted to build a bridge to the past, and Bill Clinton countered that he wanted to build a bridge to the future. When Gallup asked in 1939 whether people were happier and more contented in the horse and buggy days, 62% said that they were. When they followed up that question with would you rather live in those days, 70% said that they would not. Other questions show that Americans believed in the 1930s and 1940s and continue to believe in many recent polls that people worked harder, were more honest, and that sexual morality was better in earlier times. Before 1965, in a Gallup series, people said that religion was increasing its influence on everyday life. But since that time, in a question that's been asked fairly frequently, more people say that it's losing influence. When those people who say it's losing influence are asked whether that's a good or bad thing, most people say it's a bad thing. 70% of the unaffiliated say it's losing influence, but even they are divided about whether this is a good or a bad thing. 34% of the 70% say it's a good thing, and 30% say that it's bad. Coinciding roughly with the rise in religious de-identification, we've also seen significant movement in the liberal direction on many social issues in the polls and a rise in non-judgmentalism. Gallup asks about 16 different behaviors, everything from wearing fur to euthanasia and abortion. And people say that most of these behaviors are not acceptable for them personally, but they believe that they're morally acceptable for society. Even though there's been movement in the liberal direction, there's still deep divisions about many of these questions among denominations. Let's take having a baby outside marriage, a question that Gallup's asked since 2000. In 2000, 45% said it was morally acceptable for society. That increased to 61% this year. There were denominational chasms. 80% of those with no religious affiliation said it's morally acceptable, compared to 68% of Jews, 59% of Catholics, 47% of Protestants, and 25% of Mormons. Self-identified liberals have moved dramatically on this issue. Self-identified conservatives haven't moved at all in 15 years. Denominational gaps aren't new, but they're especially large now. Findings such as these explain why religious conservatives have become an influential part of the GOP, while secular liberals have become an important part of the Democratic coalition. Another story from the campaign touching on religion wasn't related to either of the candidates. I spent a lot of time looking at Ivanka and Chelsea as representatives of a new emerging female electorate. Both of these young women married outside their faiths. According to Pew, about 4 in 10 people who have married since 2010 are in religiously mixed marriage, compared to 19% who got married before 1960. Pew says that this appears to be linked to the growth of the religiously unaffiliated. Looking at another group, white Catholics continued their impressive track run of voting for the winner, 10 out of 12 in the recent elections. They're one of only a few groups that have a near-perfect record of voting for the winner. Another group, which the pollsters call Some College, but which bears a striking resemblance to the white working class, also has a similar impressive track record. Non-white Catholics voted solidly for Clinton, 67%. And as Bill pointed out the last time we were here, the Catholic Church has lost more parishioners than most other denomination, yet Catholics remain about 1/4 of the population, held up or kept up by the increasing number of Hispanic Catholics in the population. As we all know, white born-again and evangelical Christians voted overwhelmingly for Trump, giving him 81% of their votes. They voted for Mitt Romney and George W. Bush by similar margins. Trump won the vote of this group in 19 of the 27 GOP primaries, and Cruz won them in 8. They were older. 67% of them were older than 45. 65% of them are married. 53% female. 49% living in the suburbs. 44% in the South, 29% in the Midwest, 13% in the East, and 14% in the West. And as I said, 49% from suburbs and 30% from small towns overall. A number of evangelical observers have been critical of this question on the exit poll. They argue that the evangelical community is no longer older whites from the South, that it's becoming much more diverse and much more brown. And I think it probably is time to rethink the way the exit pollsters have asked the question. And I brought with me, if any of you would like to see it, the exit poll broken out by white born-agains and evangelicals in the fourth wave of the exit poll data. So these numbers are not widely available, I think, at this point overall. So I think it's probably a good idea if they change the category. They also argue that it doesn't provide a true picture of the views of many people on the religious right, many of whom resisted Trump from the start. And I think that we seem to think that the evangelical vote is about the size that it was 4 years ago. In the exit poll, there were not significant differences in the votes of white evangelicals are born again based on religious attendance, as some had predicted. We know that that is true for other groups, and it's really quite significant. Those who attend church more often tend to be more conservative and Republican, but it wasn't true about this overwhelming evangelical vote. 54% of white born again or evangelical Christians attended church once a week or more, and they voted 81% for Trump. So there were really no differences in those who attended once a week and those who attended a few times a year in terms of Trump support. They've changed the wording in the exit poll of the question on frequency, how often you attend church, and so I'm not sure that we can make a comparison to past years from the data overall. White evangelicals and born-agains did not overwhelmingly endorse Donald Trump's behavior. Those who were bothered a lot by his treatment of women, 26% of evangelical Christians voted for Clinton. More than half, 56%, were bothered, as I said, about this, and two-thirds of that group voted for Clinton, more than half, 56%, were bothered a lot or some less bothered by his treatment of women, and two-thirds of that group voted for him. But they're Republicans now, and as we learned in other areas on election day, such as gender, party identification is a more powerful political variable. Many different kinds of voters took a gamble on Trump because they wanted change. They didn't have a high opinion of him. The white working class and religious conservatives, I think, felt under siege in this election for different reasons, and they voted for Trump. It's hard to know exactly what people meant when they said that they wanted a candidate who would bring needed change. That was the top response when asked about four qualities that were important to you on election day. We know that these people are pretty disgusted with the way that Washington works. But in a July release from Pew about what regular churchgoers were hearing from the pulpit, nearly half, more than any of the other groups that they asked about, said that they were hearing a lot about religious liberty. And David Bernstein of George Mason wrote an interesting column in the Post earlier in the week in which he was describing evangelicals' reaction to the Obergefell decision overall. And he talked about an exchange between Justice Alito and the Solicitor General on the tax-exempt status in the Bob Jones case and whether that would then apply to religious institutions going forward. And he argued at that time that that spread like wildfire in the evangelical community overall. So I think they were hearing an enormous about issues involving religious liberty. In a Pew poll in January in 2016, only 15% of white evangelicals said that the Democratic Party was friendly to religion, while nearly half, 46%, said it was unfriendly and a third neutral. Nearly half, 48% of white evangelicals said the Republican Party was friendly to religion. And in a Pew poll released this week, 41% said that there was a lot of or some discrimination against evangelicals today, the lowest of any of the eight groups that Pew inquired about. 50% of Republicans said that there was a lot or some, and 33% of Democrats gave that response. So the threat mentality, the siege mentality, I think, was real in this community overall. And the exit poll clearly showed that they cared about the Supreme Court. Three-quarters said appointments to the Supreme Court were either the most important or an important factor in deciding their votes, and they voted 85% for Trump. Just a word about a few other issues. The exit pollsters didn't ask about abortion or gay marriage this year. None of the public polls that I saw asked about abortion after the third debate, where Clinton and Trump debated the issue. Views remain deeply contradictory, with Americans continuing to believe that it's murder and that it should be a personal choice between a woman and her doctor. Those are profoundly contradictory responses. But most Americans, and I think this will be interesting to see, depending on Trump's Supreme Court nominee, about whether or not they pull away from the playing field, leaving it to the activists who don't see the gray that most Americans see on the issue. On gay marriage, we've clearly hit a pause, but probably not a plateau. Around a third of Americans in nearly all of the polls this year, including 26% of young people in the latest Harvard IOP poll, are opposed to gay marriage and describe it as morally wrong. Again, that number has not moved significantly over the course of this year. With generational replacement, we'll probably see a change, but I think, as most of you know, we haven't seen a change on views on abortion with generational replacements as younger voters take over from older voters overall. So those are just some of the stories that I looked at in the data. I know you're all pretty familiar with the overall data, so I just tried to focus on a few things that you might not have seen overall. I'll turn it over to Bill.
Can we have this one working when the Q&A starts? Push it and see if it works now.
Is this working?
Good. But this one's not, so we got to get that fixed while he's talking, if you don't mind. Ladies and gentlemen, you have your bio of Bill Gostin in front of you, and it's very impressive. Let me just say that we had Bill here 4 years ago on this same topic, and one of your colleagues, David Brooks, is here, and after the session, David said, Bill Gostin is the smartest man in Washington. So with that, I introduce to you now Dr. Bill Gostin. Thank you, Bill, for coming again. I think it's your third or fourth time with us.
It's my third time, and I have to say that this is an invitation that I will, you know, move heaven and earth to accept if at all possible. I'm always grateful for it, it's always a great learning experience for me. There's nothing quite like it. So thank you for including me. If you're looking for diversity on this panel, gender is about it. because Carlin and I are mining and relying on the very same data sets. We're looking at the same facts. We're reaching very similar conclusions, and we agreed that I would go second and fill in or emphasize whatever she didn't talk about, because I prepared a kind of a soup to nuts party favor chart pack for you. And let me just review some of the basics quickly. First of all, for those of you who are perhaps are not full-time or regular religion reporters, there are some long-term trends, if you'll take a look at the chart on page one, that are worth attending to. This is the composition of the electorate. And as you can see, starting on the left, the blue at the bottom is white evangelical voters as a share of the electorate, and that's a story of continuity rather than change. For the orange, which is mainline Protestants, it's a story of change rather than continuity. In fact, mainline Protestants, white Protestants as a share of the electorate, have been cut just about in half during the 20 years from 1996 to 2016. African Americans, a story of continuity. White Catholics, like white mainline Protestants, a story of change, a decline in the electorate from 21% to only 13%. Interestingly, 13% of the population as we speak, according to Pew, is made up of former Catholics, one of the largest religious groups in the country, former Catholics. Of the people who were raised Catholic a generation ago, about 13% have left. About 3% have moved in. And so the Catholic share of the overall population during the overall electorate during the past generation has fallen by 10 percentage points. This is quite dramatic. As you can see from this chart, and I'll drill down a little bit on this later, the green representing the unaffiliated share of the electorate has risen quite dramatically during this period. Now, moving right along to the unaffiliated voters, this is an interesting story, and it corresponds to some larger trends in American politics. If you'll take a look at the period between the middle of the 1990s and I'm on page 2 now. Just flip over. There you go. Middle of the 1990s and roughly the middle of the first decade of the 21st century, it's a period of substantial continuity. As a matter of fact, it's a period of substantial continuity overall. And so you had a pattern of elections during this period where the basic tectonic plates were locked in place, and you had a series of close elections revolving around roughly the same electorate. And then unaffiliated took off like a rocket, starting a little bit more than a decade ago. And the unaffiliated share of the population is rising very rapidly. If you take a look at the electorate, which is broken out in chart number 3, you'll see the share of unaffiliated has gone up from 8 to 21%. If you go to page 4, you'll see a generational picture where, if you start on the right and work backwards, white Christians are 67% of the 65 and olders. They're 29% of the 18 to 29s. And similarly, if you work backwards from the oldest to the youngest, unaffiliateds are 11% of the oldest cohort of Americans and fully 34% of the youngest. Here's another way of looking at these data, using a slightly different data set. If you look at 18 to 29-year-olds in 1986, let's go ahead 10 years at a time, 86, 96, 2006, 2016. 18 to 29s in 1986 were 10% of the electorate. Unaffiliateds. Unaffiliateds were 10% of 18 to 29-year-olds. By 96, they were 20%. By 2006, very little change, 23%. 2016, 39%. In one 10-year period, unaffiliateds as a share of 18 to 29-year-olds went from 23% to 39%. This new generation is different. That's my takeaway. We don't know why. We don't know what it means. We don't know whether it will last, but what we know as a snapshot right now is that something big has happened to the young adults in the past 10 years, and it might be interesting to have some discussion of what that is. That, in my judgment, is a big story. If you take a look historically at the party religious coalitions, starting with Republicans, you can read across from 96 to 2016. And what you see, the blue at the bottom are white evangelicals, is substantial continuity of Republican reliance on white evangelicals, dramatically diminished reliance on white mainliners, and continuity among white Catholics. I did a little back-of-the-envelope calculation and let me take you forward for a minute to page, come on, Bill.
Okay. I'm sorry. I should have written this page reference down, and I have not, but I'll find it. Yes, here we are. Page 10. I figured that there was a typo, so I checked it out. Okay, these are from the CNN exit polls. And take a look at the findings on white born-again or evangelical Christians. Okay, what they show is, of course, a dramatic Trump victory in this group. But here's what struck me. I gawked at it. If you look at the 3/4 of the population that does not regard itself as part of the white evangelical group, Hillary Clinton carried them by almost 2-1, 60-34. And that underscores the importance of the white evangelical group for the Republican Party. This is where I did the back of the envelope calculation. I said to myself, well, white evangelicals are to the Republican Party as African Americans are to the Democratic Party, you know, the most solid and reliable and enduring bloc. But then I asked myself, well, how important? And back of the envelope calculation shows that Hillary Clinton got about 25% of her total vote from African Americans. Donald Trump got about 45% of his vote from white evangelicals. 45%. That's how important that group was, and that is how important, I believe, Mr. Trump's list of 21 Supreme Court justices turned out to be. That was a major moment in the campaign. I think that persuaded the evangelical community that he had made a commitment to them about Supreme Court nominations, a binding commitment that he would not break. Another way of looking at all of this is on chart page 13, reliance on right Christian votes by party. And what you see here is a story of continuity for one party and change for the other. Basically, the Republican Party is about as reliant on white Christian voters as it was when Bill Clinton was first elected president. But look at what happened to the Democrats. That one chart, I think, speaks volumes about the differences between the two political parties. If you'll go to chart number 15, the line on this chart represents the least squares line. And what you'll see is that there is a reliable linear relationship between the share of white Christians as a share of the total electorate in the state and the overall vote in the state. That's what you'd expect, but the fact that that is such a smooth line with such a steep angle shows the importance of that electorate. This beautiful color chart with grays and whites, page 16, grays and whites, and reds and dark reds, illustrates visually the states where white Christians remain dominant. The darker the red, the higher the density of the white Christian population. And you'll see West Virginia and Kentucky, Iowa, substantial portions of the upper Midwest, all in that category. Once again, the Trump campaign knew exactly what it was doing, and it, I think, strategically targeted precisely the populations that would be needed to produce victory over very considerable odds, I think. I do want to leave you, since I'm eager to get to the discussion, Well, stop for a minute. If you're interested during the Q&A, we can go back to the most decisive states, Florida, Ohio, Michigan, and Wisconsin, and drill down into them. I've provided some of the statistics from the exit polls in all of those states. But I do want to get, in conclusion, to what I think is one of the most interesting and significant questions posed by the 2016 election. Namely, what is the nature of the religious vote in America today? Is it a vote where religious doctrine, belief, practice shapes a political outlook? Or does the causal arrow run more strongly the other way around? That is to say, different religious groups have different political outlooks. And as circumstances change, they will retrofit their convictions in order to make doctrine and political preference align. Now, why do I raise this question? Please take a look at page 21. Question. Do you think an elected official who commits an immoral act in their personal life can still behave ethically and fulfill their duties in public and professional life? Here's that question put to white evangelicals. In 2011, only 30% gave an affirmative answer to that question. And oddly, in 2016, 72% gave an affirmative answer to that question. I wonder what happened in the interim. Could it have been a doctrinal revolution? Somehow I don't think so. I'm tempted to quote Kierkegaard at this point on the, describing, Abraham's intended sacrifice of Isaac. Kierkegaard called that the teleological suspension of the ethical. Could we see a similar process at work here? Now, I don't mean to single out any particular religious group, so why don't we flip now to page 22, the final page. Because white evangelicals were not alone in making this switch. As you'll see, among all Americans, it went from 44 to 61. Among evangelicals, as I said before, from 30 to 72. Among mainliners, from 38 to 60. Among Catholics, from 42 to 58. Only unaffiliateds who separated the public and private all along were relatively unchanged. Now, it would be presumptuous of me as a reasonably practicing Jew to characterize this as a crisis of faith or doctrine or conscience or what have you. I have no standing to say that. But it does seem to me that this is something worth thinking about, because those of us who study these questions, as EJ and I have at Brookings, EJ for even longer than I have at Brookings, we have always taken seriously religious upbringing, faith, doctrine, practice as a driver of political outlook and political behavior. And we are both asking ourselves the same question. Can we do that? What impact does Catholic social thought have on Catholics, particularly white Catholics? What impact do personalistic doctrines of ethical conduct, whether in private or in public, have on the mainstream evangelical outlook? Those are not rhetorical questions, but I think they go to the heart of the matter. When we're studying religion in politics, what are we studying? Are we studying religion in politics, or are we studying politics in religion? And I can put that question on the table. I have a feeling the table collectively is better qualified to answer that question than I can. But in my judgment, that is the principal question about religion that this election put on the table.
Thank you, Bill. Thank you. Well, we already have six names on the list, and Carl Cannon's first, and then Will Salatin, and Kirsten, and Pete, and Sally, and Tom. But Carl, bring the mic over and push the button on, and you're up. Robert? Is the button on?
Yeah, it's on. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Is there any reason to believe that millennials will get more conservative as boomers have? And does becoming more conservative politically correlate with becoming more religious? These are what I wonder about.
Okay. Well, we've seen it in every previous generation, and perhaps the millennials will be different. They're certainly saying they're very spiritual as opposed to religion, and that could be because they lack confidence in organized religion. Of those Gallup numbers that I mentioned, they're really quite dramatic for younger people overall over time. I think we're going to have to wait and see. I mean, they've not moved the other way on abortion, but they look pretty much like the population as a whole, probably because of sonograms, probably because they've seen that picture of their little brother and sister. So they haven't moved uniformly, and different groups of millennials have moved in different directions. For example, women, young female millennials who voted for Romney, who voted for, they're a little bit more conservative on a lot of issues overall, whether it's registering for the draft or marijuana for all the predictable reasons. So I think we're still in a wait and see. We just don't know whether they're going to be fundamentally different.
Good question, Carl, and I can't fully answer it, but here are three points to keep in mind. First of all, data from the Public Religion Research Institute indicates that unaffiliateds are increasingly likely to remain unaffiliated as they age. Right? If you go back a couple of generations, unaffiliateds when young tended to reaffiliate when older. The evidence that reaffiliation is taking place is not there. As a matter of fact, it appears not to be. Now, there are some methodological questions that you could raise about that, but still, the second point that I'm about to make, I think, supports that, namely that millennials tend to be very suspicious about institutions in general, especially organized religion. And I do think, and there's evidence in Bob Putnam and David Campbell's wonderful book, American Grace, to support this, that the period of the most intense participation by Christian conservatives in the political scene pushed a lot of millennials away and pushed them away from trust. The third point, and this is something that emerged when EJ and I started going through the crosstabs of one of the surveys that we have the privilege of doing on a regular basis with the Public Religion Research Institute. Younger evangelicals, if anything, are more liberal than older evangelicals on a range of social questions. And there is evidence of diminished intensity among younger evangelicals around those questions. So put those three things together, and it doesn't fully answer your question, but it does suggest ways of thinking about it.
Just to add quickly to what Bill said about their lack of confidence in central institutions, one of those is marriage. And 30% of millennials are the product of divorce, and I think that's also affecting their religious views overall, and also the fact that so many are being raised in mixed religion households these days. And they're also having fewer children. And in that Time Yankelevich survey and then the Peter Hart survey for Rolling Stone in 1988, children were just enormously important in bringing people back to the voting booth, back to church. And I thought that was particularly interesting in that survey. And of course, millennials are having fewer children.
Will Salatin, bring the microphone over.
I wanted to pick up on something both of you said, but especially Bill's closing remarks about the mixture of politics and religion and the change there. Let me just put on the table three different kinds of issues that someone might vote on in this area. Deal killers, where you have an absolute standard. If you're not with me on this, I don't vote for you. Transactional issues, where, as in economics, you give me something, I vote for you. And the third one is sort of an interest group appeal. It's not a universal kind of moral argument. It's about something I'm going to do for your group, even if it's not a transaction. There were some cultural issues in this election that Democrats thought would be deal killers that weren't. In the civil rights movement, racism was a moral issue. It was a religious issue. We had a candidate this year, obviously, who said that a Mexican-American judge couldn't fairly judge him, who said that we should ban a religious group, a non-Christian religious group from this country, at least on a temporary basis. Those turned out not to be deal killers for a lot of people, including a lot of white Christians. What a lot of the white Christians seem to have gone for instead, as you guys discussed, was first a transactional appeal, a list of Supreme Court justices. Disregard the candidate, focus on this list of people he'll give you for the Supreme Court. Secondly, an interest group appeal, which was the religious freedom argument, but it was religious freedom for Christians, but not for the group of people, namely Muslims, who would be excluded from the country. So that was not a universal argument. It was something for this group. So this brings me back to what Carly said about that there's been a shift on the left and among Democrats, a decline of some of this religious affiliation and perhaps moral voting, but not on the right. Are we actually seeing a change on the right, consistent with what Bill was saying? Are we seeing a shift from deal killers, from absolute standards, to a transactional mentality and to an interest group mentality?
Want to go first?
Here's my problem, Will. I almost think that you need to be an insider in communion with the group we're talking about in order to give a responsible answer to that question. And, you know, with the permission of the moderator.
You have it.
You know, in the taxi ride over, you know, I put this question, Pete Wehner and I took the taxi from the airport to the hotel, and I put a version of your question to him as, you know, as a faithful member of the group that we're talking about. And he provided a very interesting series of answers to that question. I wonder, rather than answering it myself, whether I might turn to Pete for as a kind of a, as someone who lives this. It's not just an object of study.
Sure. Pete, yes.
Thank you, Bill and Will.
You're on, man.
Yeah. During the cab ride over, when we were talking about the explanation for why white evangelicals had such large supports for Trump, this is essentially what I told Bill. One was a deep antipathy for Hillary Clinton, which I think shouldn't be underestimated. Whether one thinks that's fair or not, it was something beyond anything that I've seen within American politics. She's been on the scene for a long time. Well, some of this is based on my own reading of the data, but also anecdotal. I was in touch with a lot of white evangelical Christians, friends of mine, to try and understand what was animating their support for Trump. I was fairly vocal in my opposition to him, but I did try and listen to them. So I think that was one thing that was very large. That just came up. I had breakfast with a pastor a few weeks ago, and he told me that there was someone within the church that he knew that he said that if Hillary Clinton was on the ballot against Satan, the person would vote for Satan. And I think he meant that only half kiddingly, that the intensity was that deep. Some of it, I think, is specific to Hillary Clinton. Some of it was really specific to the Supreme Court, if there was one issue that you could tie it to that I think animated a lot of Christians. It was the Supreme Court and religious liberties. Carlin's quite right. That conversation between the Solicitor General and the Supreme Court Justice during that debate, where said essentially it was read as that churches may at some point, if they don't adopt the views of the state as it relates to same-sex marriage, could face consequences for it, was huge. So if you're part of the evangelical community and you think same-sex marriage is the driving issue, I think you're probably wrong. It's actually the religious liberties, at least in my experience. That's what I've heard the most, is fear that these institutions will not be allowed to abide by their own conscience. And the other thing that I heard a lot about was this kind of apocalyptic rhetoric. As Carlin said, people feeling under siege. The language that I heard, and Mike, I know you and I have talked about this too, was some variation of we're losing the country. That came up a lot. This is the last chance, that if we don't stop it now, this will be lost. And they meant by that a kind of cultural loss more than an economic loss. But that came up a lot. I sensed fear, which often gives rise to anger. That was my sort of short version of what I saw with a lot of evangelicals. So the sense of the siege mentality. As far as then there was some group of white evangelicals that I think voted for Trump because sort of through gritted teeth. But then there were a fair amount that were actually enthusiastic, and that was the part I frankly didn't get. And I was trying to understand that. And part of what I think the answer to me was that they view Trump as strong. It went deeper than a set of issues. It was a kind of cultural event or a sort of visceral event. And I got the sense, and others can weigh in on this, that the sort of disrespect and dishonor that blue-collar voters feel has happened is now with white evangelicals. Now, I don't think that's actually a fully fair assessment to make, but that's what they felt. And I think that they saw in Donald Trump a figure who would stand up to the elites that they felt like had disrespected them, and that he was a vehicle for their frustrations and their anger. Arlie Hochschild wrote a very lovely book. She's a UC Berkeley sociologist, and she went and spent 5 years in Louisiana. It's a bayou country, to understand. She's liberal. She wanted to understand first the Tea Party and then Trump supporters, and she developed a real affection for the people there, even though she disagreed with them politically and culturally. And admired them in many ways, their sense of community. They were personally kind to her. But she was able to talk about what she described as the fear and mourning, mourning, on the American right. And that was really, really present. So I think the way that, at least that I understood the appeal of Trump, was not economic, it was not policy specific, it was visceral and it was cultural. And for a lot of white evangelicals, there's a sense that the country is changed. Of course, it is, and they're fearful of that. And I just wanted to say one other thing apropos of what Bill said. I do think that there was a lot of retrofitting for exactly what you said. You know, on the numbers of morality in public leaders, but it was complicated because I do think that a lot of white evangelicals felt like Trump on his kind of court religious liberties was right, and they put that as a higher priority, and so they took these issues that had animated them decades earlier as it relates to the importance of character in public life and set those aside. But that chart that you showed was a kind of CAT scan on a hypocrisy, and I remember during the Clinton years, the same evangelicals who were talking about the importance of virtue and character in public leaders were now in this election saying that we're electing a pastor, a president, not a pastor. And so I think that that now they tell us so.
Thank you, Bill, for that intervention. That's very helpful. Kirsten, you're next. So bring that. Will, I have a feeling you had a follow-up, or did you? Are you set?
It just sounds to me, listening to Pete, that it sounds like the decline of Christianity or of Christian voting into a form of identity politics. It seems to be a surrender of universal values in favor of a sense of personal identity and a sense of the country that they feel that they're losing that can't be construed as universal. But maybe I'm misreading that.
I think that's a reasonable assumption, and I think it's a more reasonable assumption given the election this year.
Yeah. Okay, so, Kirsten Powers.
Yeah. So all my questions have been asked, but maybe Pete can answer this though, because this was a version of what I was going to ask, but you basically answered it. I mean, so when you look at this hypocrisy on the issue of ethics, but then you consider the fact that even white evangelicals and frankly, some conservative white Catholics do feel that there's an existential threat. The Democrats pose an existential threat to them, that they actually feel that they are in danger of not being able to voice their views of their faith, perhaps maybe, setting aside whether this is true or not, you know, that they may not be able to, practice their religion with the freedom that they think that they should. Is there actually anything wrong with retrofitting? Believe that, I mean, I guess first maybe address is it okay for them to believe that? And second of all, if they do believe that, wouldn't this just be the normal thing that you would do? You would relegate the character issue to a lower level, and maybe Carolyn, you can address this. You know, you relegate to a lower level, and you would focus on the more existential threat.
Could I just add quickly? And Bill, as a political theorist, you might, you know, Niebuhr had this whole theory of Christian realism. And a political realism, which then would, we might say, retrofitting is a part of realism. And I'm sorry, but this is what we got. This is my choices, mm-hmm. and I'm going to retrofit this. Your comment? And instead of saying inconsistent or hypocritical, I'm retrofitting because this is what I have to do.
And also, is anything I just said captured in the data? I mean, do you see this anywhere?
What I put on the table at the very end of my chart pack is all I know about this. And I put it on the table to raise the question, not to answer it, because I can't. I will say this, and by the way, I did not use the word hypocrisy.
I know.
Someone else used that word. And, Kirsten, for very much the reasons you just stated, you know, I'm reluctant to frame the issue in exactly that way. I will say this, invoking a point of personal privilege as a former member of the Clinton administration, during which this principle of, you know, the previous formulation of the relationship between private ethics and public life was presented not as something negotiable, but right. as a deontological threshold issue, right? If you didn't clear the bar of personal rectitude, it didn't matter what you believed, mm-hmm. right? And it didn't matter how sincere and evangelical you were doctrinally. If you sinned, now obviously if you sinned, you could be forgiven, there was not a lot of evidence of forgiveness during that period. So suddenly something deontological has turned into something negotiable. Now, by the way...
Excuse me, Bill, if I could.
Yes.
Define the word, just in case anybody didn't know, deontological.
Deontological is a fancy Kantian way of saying an absolute principle that can't be waived because waiving it would be conducive to achieving ends.
Right? It's
just, for anybody that would,
sorry about that. It's an absolute principle of conduct that you can't breach. And there are political equivalents of that. There's an old Latin tag, you know, let justice rule though the heavens fall, on their personal versions of that. And the formula, and if it is now negotiable, then that represents an important doctrinal shift. That's all I'm saying. By the way, having written an article called Political Realism myself and being a great admirer of Niebuhr, I think there's much to be said for the more flexible conception of the relationship between means and ends. The only point I'm making is that this is not a community where it was previously formulated in those terms, I think would be fair
to say. Exactly. I have you down, Catherine. Is it on this point? Okay, you're on the list, and others are also up. Pete, you were actually up, but Carlin, I'll bring you in, but Pete, you were up next after. Carlin, you want to make a point here? Yeah.
Just a comment about retrofitting. I don't think there's anything in the data beyond that question, and Bill and I have talked about that question because I tried to go back to an earlier era to look at what I saw was extraordinary retrofitting, and I wonder whether this might be related to political polarization. I remember we were sort of taught by the feminists in the 60s and the 70s that the personal was political. Then all of a sudden Bill Clinton comes on the scene and the personal is no longer the political. I mean, you have this just extraordinary 180-degree turn, and I tried to look at that to see whether women had become more democratic, what in the world was going on there that changed their views so dramatically on something that had been a core principle of everything they had told us in the 1960s and 70s. And you really couldn't find a lot in the data, but there certainly is more political polarization now, and that may be contributing to the retrofitting. So
both sides can play this
game.
Okay, Pete, you were on the list for a question. And by the way, let me just encourage everyone, feel free to tweet.
It is true, by the way, that retrofitting, the treatment of women didn't matter to a lot of liberals when Clinton was president. Now it matters with Trump. So that does go both ways, whether it's flexibility or hypocrisy, however one wants to term it. My original question, Bill, was that you had said that this new generation is different and that something has happened. And I guess you answered it, but if you wanted to elaborate, I'd be interested in very specifically what happened. But beyond that, on this issue of less trust in institutions, and both of you weigh in on this, and the failure of institutions, I'm wondering for the millennial generation, is that something that is driven by a kind of an empirical assessment, that is, that institutions have failed and they therefore have said, look, these institutions are incompetent and they don't deserve our trust? That's one explanation. Another one is it's a kind of philosophical detachment, that is, there's a deinstitutionalization that is happening because of views toward authority, something deeper. I imagine it's probably both, but I'd be interested in how you disaggregate that. And if you have any thoughts, either of you, on this, what for the millennial generation would cause a reattachment to religious institutions? Clearly, they're not identifying with them now, and I'm wondering if religious institutions in general are saying something that isn't connecting with where that generation is, and where that connection might occur if it could.
That's very good. Yeah.
So, was that addressed to both of us? Because I'm
to Bill.
I'm doing a lot of talking here. I don't want to take up more than my share of airtime.
That's okay.
But so, why don't Carlin go first? And
institutions is pretty much across all institutions, but there are exceptions. The military is extraordinarily highly regarded by young people. And I think in trying to understand the declining in trust in institutions, I think we're looking in some of the wrong places. I think there are actually some other things than the conventional performance measure that relate to declining trust. First, and this relates specifically to why the military might be regarded so much more positively than other institutions. Its mission is clearly and narrowly defined, and it carries it out well. Whereas all these other institutions, like government, vast missions, a lot to do, and there's a lot to criticize. If you look, for example, at trust in the 60s and 70s, when it was higher than it is right now, I mean, we had a kind of tacit compact with with our government. Government didn't do much. There wasn't a lot to criticize. But when government started to get so much bigger in the 1960s, you just see this wave of criticism. And another reason, I think, contributing to the lack of trust, and I'm not sure this relates specifically to millennials, is that a lot of big moral issues were decided by constitutional amendment, and we do that very differently now. And I think that it made it possible to, if states were deciding an issue overall, there wasn't the kind of national drama on these issues overall. So I think those are two reasons that contribute to declining trust. But what might reattach millennials to church? This is completely anecdotal, but I've seen a really interesting change in the smart young kids who come to AEI to be research assistants over the 37 years I've been there. The first ones who came all wanted to spend 2 years at AEI. We tell them they're going to come to AEI for 2 years, and then they should go back to graduate school or do something different. And they all, you know, decided they wanted to get a law degree or Kennedy School degree, something like that, and then they wanted to come back to Washington. That's completely changed now. They still want to go to get the degree from the Kennedy School or law school, but they want to go back to their local communities where they think they can make a difference. It's just amazing how many of them are talking this way to me about going back to Austin, Texas. And I think if there is going to be a reattachment, it's going to be to things at the local level where conceivably they'll see the work that churches and other groups do to solve problems in local communities. And people are much more positive about what's happening at their local level, at their local government and state government, than they are about what's happening in Washington. So I think they're hopeful. And they're also, there's another big change in this group overall, and I don't know whether it brings them back to church, but they are, I think they're eventually, when they, you know, when the 27-year-old moves out of our house or whatever it's going to be, but I think they're going to be a remarkably self-reliant generation because they just don't think they can count on marriage, on government, on business overall. And Jeff Guerin, who does a lot of work, as for many years, the Democratic pollster, does a lot of work for one of the networks, has asked young people for years what they want to be when they grow up. It's an open-ended question. You can give whatever response you want. And in the 1990s, they began seeing something they'd never seen before. A lot of these young people were volunteering. They wanted to be small businessmen or small businesswomen. They could rely on themselves because they couldn't rely on these other big institutions, and that then works back to the local, where I think you're just going to see, and this is a silver lining of all the distrust in federal institutions, where you're going to see really perhaps robust activity at the local level. So.
Well, that, you know, I think that's a very good take on the more political side of the question. With regard to the attachment, I won't even say reattachment, because for many millennials it would be a first attachment to an organized religious institution. You have to distinguish, you know, as the demographers do, between life cycle effects and cohort effects. And I am sure that as millennials age and as more of them grow into more traditional patterns of family and home ownership, that you will see an uptick in religious attachment. But where you start has a lot, as a generation, has a lot to do with where you end up as a generation. And so if you begin at the age of 25 a lot farther down in the attachment scale than your parents and grandparents, then when you're 45, as a cohort, as a generation, you're going to be, you know, you're going to be lower than that. I really believe that the crucial variable here is family. I know that doing sociology introspectively with an N of one, namely myself, that, you know, if our son, if we hadn't made the decision to send our son to a religious school, I would not be who I am today. I would not be institutionally affiliated. I would not be doctrinally serious, et cetera, et cetera. And the fact that millennials are taking a lot longer to get married, probably a record share will never marry, a record share will have no children, I think this does not augur well for institutional reattachment, at least to religious institutions, because everywhere I look, it's the children that lead parents to religion and not the other way around, oddly enough. Probably, maybe not in your community, but in mine, for sure. hand. I don't think mine is an idiosyncratic experience.
Sally Quinn, pull the microphone over.
Just so much to ask about. I'm trying to sort of pull my thoughts together because I do want to say one thing about the retrofitting of the women during the Clinton administration. I mean, it was, I thought, mind-boggling and appalling that the feminist would suddenly be accepting of what Bill Clinton did. You know, the mantra was, if she says it's rape, except when Juanita Broderick said it was rape, it wasn't rape, and on and on. But that wasn't a religious issue. And I think that was, in terms of retrofitting, I think that was all about politics. So I think there's a difference there. I spoke recently to Anne Graham Lotz, who's Billy Graham's daughter, and who's very, very religious. This was before the campaign, and she said, you know, I can't vote for Hillary, but I just can't vote for Trump because ethically and morally he just doesn't stand for the values that I stand for. And, you know, and we have the example of Russell Moore, who sort of basically had a nervous breakdown over Trump. So
he's,
you know,
feeling better now.
So you did have that, you know, that there were those people, but I'm still baffled by the evangelical vote. I don't understand it. And I don't understand it because every time Donald Trump would say something that was mean or untrue or hateful or disrespectful, I mean, when he mocked the reporter who was disabled, I mean, I have a disabled child. I know a lot of people who have disabled children or disabled. There were things like that that were so over the top. And all I could think about when he was saying those things was WWJD, what would Jesus do? And it just seemed to me that his behavior on every level was un-Christian. His values, his morals, his ethics were un-Christian. Now, that may not be a bad thing to some people. And so I don't know how, I mean, yes, you're not electing a pastor, you're electing a president. But on the other hand, the president is the leader, and on some level, the president is a moral leader.
Sally, I do need a question.
Yeah. Oh, am I making a speech?
Yes. Sort of.
Well, I think I'm sort of asking the question at the same time because I'm saying I don't understand at what point did the evangelicals say, is this the example that I want to set for my children? Is this the example that this is how I want my children to be raised? Is this what I want them to believe in? Is this how I want them to interact with other people and the church and the leadership and parents and with other people? I don't understand. And retrofitting doesn't work. I mean, that word just doesn't work. Where is it in their Bible, in their religious, in their prayers at night, in their interaction with other people? Where is it that behavior was okay for the leader of our country and an example of who we are in the world, and how does that square with their own their own religious values and morals and ethics? That's my question. Is that okay?
That's a good question. And let me just quickly add, one of the things that's not in these numbers, and I'd like for the two of you to address, is two things. One, how many evangelicals didn't vote for either one but voted for an independent or a write-in? I know a lot who did. Just didn't like either choice, period. And number two, how many evangelicals stayed home and just said, this is not the year for me to vote? I don't think that's in your data, is it, Bill or Carlin? Maybe you have a hunch, though, because that would be part. The 81%, we don't know what that number of 81%, how many people that was, as opposed to what it could have been. Go ahead.
Well, Carla and I are going to say the same thing about yeah. that.
Well, go ahead and say it now, and I'll have her.
Okay, well, she has the numbers right in front of her.
Yeah, I'm looking to see.
But, okay, well, while you're looking for the numbers, I'll just say that the preliminary apples-to-apples unreliable exit poll data suggests that evangelicals as a share of the electorate this year were almost exactly the same as they were 4 years ago. So there's no evidence either of an evangelical surge or an evangelical retreat. I will also say that when you add up 81% and 16%, you get 97% of evangelicals, which suggests that relatively few of them, as a share of the total, cast a vote for an independent candidate. You see evidence of that on the Mormon side, but not the evangelical side, for obvious reasons. And Mormons were the only non-liberal denomination where Hillary Clinton did statistically significantly better than Obama did in 2012, 4 points better, if memory serves.
Was exactly what I would say.
Perfect. Okay, good. We're going to move right along.
Oh, I don't. I didn't.
Sally?
No. You didn't answer the question. About the morals
why?
And the values. How do you get from your ethics and morals and values to.
You know, I think the question was really answered very well by Pete White.
Yeah.
Feeling under siege, Trump mm-hmm. would be strong against elites. I know a lot of evangelicals said I voted for Trump holding my nose,
mm-hmm.
and they when they told me they were embarrassed to even tell me.
I think that there's another piece of what Pete said that deserves more explanation. I have to say that I understand the sense of being under siege, and trying to maximize empathy. I think if I were in their situation with the belief structure that they have, I would probably feel besieged myself. That I understand. The part that I don't understand is this intense loathing of Hillary Clinton, which strikes me as being over the top. Okay, well, this is going to be the real discussion then. Because, whatever else you want to say about her, she is, I believe, a sincere Christian, a practicing Methodist, someone whose outlook on politics has been profoundly shaped by her faith. And there are many things to dislike about her. I strike the balance between like and dislike somewhat differently from other people in this room. But I get that. But it's one thing to be an object of dislike. It's another thing to be compared unfavorably to Satan. Those are really two different modalities of thinking and feeling, are they not?
Yes.
Okay, help us out.
During the break.
Okay.
Tom, you're up next. And ladies and gentlemen, we've got a really long list, and we're about to take a break. So let's try to be concise if possible. I want to get everybody in. Tom Gelton over here.
I was struck by the same point that Pete Wehner called attention to, and that is the idea that millennials are different. And then you subsequently really elaborated, between the two of you, you elaborated on that, the distrust in institutions from marriage to voting. But to take that one step further, because those struck me as being rather benign interpretations of how millennials are different. I'm wondering if either of you have any thoughts on this study that was published in the Journal of Democracy a couple of weeks ago that shows that millennials, by striking margins, are less likely than older generations to think it's essential to live in a democracy. What you said, Carly, about the military being the one institution that they seem to have trust in, would perhaps some would say that there's consistency there. But this is sort of the more alarming angle on how millennials are different.
That study, and I haven't had time to do so yet. I noticed there's been some pushback on the monkey cage last week, but again, I apologize. I haven't had a chance to look at it yet. I don't think, for example, that they embrace socialism or that they, I mean, we saw hints of things like that during Occupy Wall Street, but I don't think it was serious. And again, I haven't looked at this new study, so I really can't comment on it.
Well, we finally reached a point of difference of nuance of interpretation.
Oh.
Finally, some diversity beyond gender. And that is, you know, Tom, and I hope I'm not just saying this because I was a board member of the National Endowment for Democracy and therefore part of the publisher of Journal of Democracy for 9 years, and it's a journal I continue to be very close to. But I can't help seeing this shift among young people in the United States in the context of broader trends throughout the Democratic West. If it were just a one-off, I think I wouldn't take it seriously. But the fact that you're seeing similar trends among young people in democracies throughout Europe, a deep impatience with institutions that seem incapable of acting. Right? If you look at the EU tied up in knots for a better part of a decade trying to deal with the economic crisis, I think it's understandable, especially in the context of of economic hard times and stagnation that have hit young people particularly hard. As someone who studies the world very carefully, you probably know the unemployment figures in Europe among young adults better than I do, but they are above 40% in a number of southern European countries. At the worst of it, they were above 50%. They're declining very slowly. This entire generation is looking at a world that doesn't make a place for them or doesn't seem to have a place for them, and from their standpoint, nobody's doing anything about it. What worries me is that during a similar period about 80 years ago, there was a turning away from parliamentary democracies seen as feckless towards various sorts of undemocratic alternatives. And the idea that there is an arc of history that moves forward and forecloses previous bad options is, in my judgment, a progressivist illusion that we would be well served to set aside in the name of a more cyclical view of history where bad stuff is inherent in human possibility and can return under adverse circumstances. I'm not a Christian, but it seems to me that would be a more squarely Christian view, would it not?
Yes, Robert Draper, you're going to take us into the break. So pull the mic up and
all right.
Right over here.
Yeah, so I'm, yeah, can you hear me? Yeah.
Is the mic on?
I think it is. I'm trying to reconcile some things here. I think that Bill was answering Sally's question, at what point do evangelicals say this is not the example I want to set for my children, with at the precise point in which the candidate under consideration is Hillary Clinton. And I'm wondering if there is some religious or cultural underpinning to the depth of antipathy for Clinton, since I think a number of us are in agreement with what Pete said, that antipathy is real, but which the data suggests is the one group without which Donald Trump could not have been president. And I'm specifically wondering whether this is more a cultural and religious thing or if it's more party identification, since after all, white evangelicals have been among the constants in this. And I think specifically of the Supreme Court list that Trump put together. I think most of us know that Trump, in fact, had nothing whatsoever to do with that list, that it was put together by Heritage and Federalist Society, that he did not know any of the names on the list, he did not add anyone to the list, he did not subtract anyone from the list, he did not ask about anyone on the list. It was purely 100% transactional. Had Hillary Clinton produced that very same list for the purposes of transactionality, evangelical voters would have likely said, we're not buying it. Because we know she is an uber Democrat. Trump instead did, and I think to me it was not so much a ratification of their hope that he would be committed to their causes, but rather a ratification of his pretending to be a Republican. So what I'm wondering is whether, you know, the antipathy is really that she is seen more in this kind of uber-partisan context, or if there's anything in the data to suggest a religious or cultural explanation for the depth of antipathy.
The data that suggested anything deeper in terms of a cultural, I think it was just somebody they've watched for an incredibly long time, and the antipathy is just has just grown over time. They didn't like him either, remember.
Right.
Yeah. This is such a negative election. Only 2% of voters had a positive view of both candidates. I mean, that's...
But would that then suggest to you that basically in the end they
did
just...
Did you say 2%?
They came home.
Yes, I did say 2%.
I think she said 2% of the election had a...
Yeah.
I'd like to meet them. Even one of them.
So I think it was party.
Look. Look, thank you for reemphasizing and underscoring the question, because... This is one of Sally's points, and certainly one of Pete's points. I do think that it requires more inquiry than it's been given. How does someone who's a mixture of virtues and vices, who is certainly not everybody's cup of tea, how does that person, over a period of 30 years, get transformed into a figure who is compared unfavorably to Satan? And by the way, Pete, I don't mean to globalize your anecdote, but I do think it captured something quite real about the intensity of the feeling, and you're not the first person I've heard this from. And she clearly has come to stand for everything that this group despises, everything, and you know. And
Bill, how much was that tied to her husband, also?
I don't know.
No, it's not. It's not.
I don't know.
It's not strongly tied to Bill right. Clinton. He still is positively regarded.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to take a 15-minute break. If you have questions for these people, try not to ask them during the break because we want to hear your question. But I assure you, almost everybody in the room is on the list. And when we come back, please do dutiful. The restrooms are downstairs and across the lobby. We'll see you in 15 minutes. Thank you.